Everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to another broadcast of Ask a Vegan. It's September 9th, 2012, and I am broadcasting from Real Worldwide Radio, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. Responsible Eating and Living is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization that I founded last year, and I am here to provide simple truth and tools about food and food choices, answer your questions about plant-based, plant-strong, plant-centered, plant food, vegan diets, and kind of keep you up to date with what's going on. So let's get started today. First, let's go to the seas. One of my favorite listeners, Ruth Ann, wrote me recently, and I just wanted to share with you what she said because it leads into some of the things I want to talk about today. So she writes, I just got home for an extended day at work. Some very thoughtful moms from my school had some sandwiches and salads brought in to help us poor old tired teachers make it through the long day. Anyway, she whispered to one of the moms, do you know if there are any vegan items on the menu? And the mom went over and then came back with a huge grin. She announced proudly, we sure do. We have tuna and pimento sandwiches. There we go for the scaly vegetable tuna. And still to this day, people are confused as to what is animal and what is vegetable. So let's just be clear here. Vegetarians are people who eat vegetables, and in addition, they can eat if they desire, based on the meaning of the word vegetarian, milk and eggs. The idea is that vegetarians don't eat flesh, and that means flesh from any animal, including fish. Fish are made of flesh, scales and flesh. Vegetarians do not eat fish. Now, there are some confused people out there that say I'm vegetarian and they eat fish, and they make it difficult for us that use these words to explain what we do and who we are. These are just words. Words really don't mean anything. But we're trying to convey a meaning by using certain words. Vegan is a little more descriptive. People who are vegan, it's not just a diet but a lifestyle where we avoid as much as possible animal products, not only in our food. Certainly we don't eat anything from an animal, including meat, chicken, fish, dairy, eggs. There's that iffy honey category. I'm not going into it today. And then there's wool and leather and silk and things that are made from innocent, exploited, sentient beings. And frankly, vegans don't support that. Okay. So when people come along and they think, you say you're a vegetarian, but you eat chicken and fish, somehow chicken and fish have gotten downgraded from beef, the king, apparently, of animal flesh. And chicken and fish, the, quote, healthier alternatives. I personally don't think they're healthier, but they, in the press, they've been given a thumbs up from many different nutritionists, dietitians, doctors, health promoters as the healthier choice when compared to beef. And somehow people relate, I don't know how it works in the brain. Maybe people think that vegetarian diets are indeed healthier, and then they hear that chicken and fish are healthier, and so they kind of mush them all together and think, well, if you're a vegetarian, you must be eating chicken and fish. Okay, well, there's lots of us out there doing this work, and the idea is to clarify and lift the veil, because clearly so many people still aren't connecting the dots. So many people aren't realizing what's on their plate. People are not realizing that what's on their plate once was a living, breathing being with dreams and desires and feelings and family and friends. there are amazing stories, not only about cows and pigs and chickens being extremely intelligent and extremely loving and caring and wanting to be with their family and wanting to be able to scratch themselves and preen themselves and breathe fresh air and roll around and experience joy. But fish do that too. And I'm not just talking about sea mammals, which are like the cows running around in the water, like whales and dolphins, which are more like us because they're mammals, but the fish too. There have been incredible accounts, incredible, of fish that show that they know where they are, that they know who they're with, and they know what they're doing. Incredible stories that will move you to tears. And all you have to do is look for them because they're everywhere. And if you actually want some recommendations about where to read some of these incredible stories about fish, just send me an email at info@realmeals.org and I will send you some reading material, or at least titles and where to find them. Really amazing, amazing things. Right, so on the subject of food from the sea, I'm going to be talking about a number of things today. Tuna, whales, and kelp. About tuna, I like to read from a variety of different sources. I'm not just focused on the vegan plant-based world because I learn a lot from places that support meat eating. Animal eating. And I read an article called Soybean Oil is a Good Alternative to Fish Oil in Tuna Diet. So this is new research. It comes out of the Czech Republic, and I'm going to read the summary. As pressure increases on fish oil for feed, more research is turning to find alternatives. And work by Amal Biswas, Kinki University, Japan, has found that soybean oil is an effective substitute to fish oil in diets of Pacific bluefin tuna. The use of fish oil in fish feed is both expensive and unstable. With the increasing concern over the future availability of fish oil, soybean oil has been studied as an alternative. The study involved 6 daily feedings to 23-day-old juvenile Pacific bluefin tuna of 1 of 4 diets with different fish oil and soybean oil ratios. The study analyzed the effect of the diets on growth performance and fatty acid consumption. And basically, there was little difference seen in body weight gain, feed consumption, or feed efficiency. The diet with soybean instead of fish oil also saw a whole body crude lipids content and lipid retention efficiency increase. As a result of the little difference between diets, it was stated that soybean oil was seen to be a suitable replacement for fish oil, and that 10 to 20% of fish oil can be replaced by soybean oil, helping to reduce costs. Okay, what's the point of reading this little summary of this article? So we've been fish farming a variety of different fish in order to satisfy the demand of the public, which is growing. The public's growing because our population is growing. We're now close to 7 billion people. And a lot of these people want to eat more fish. And so we farm the fish. And what's kind of crazy is we scoop out of the ocean a lot of sea life that people aren't really interested in eating. Smaller fish and all kinds of things, and scoop them out of the ocean, clear the ocean out of life, and grind them up and make fish feed. And the ocean is really not doing well because we are treating it so poorly. Not only are we dumping all kinds of toxic chemicals into the ocean, but we're with all kinds of crazy high-tech contraptions, trawlers, and different ways to literally clear all life out of the water. The oceans are dying. And we need the ocean for so many different reasons. And so this is not a good thing. scooping out all of this life to grind up into fish meal to feed fish in fish farms. It's not environmentally sustainable. Let's not even talk about whether this food is healthy or not. So they're discovering that soybean oil might be a partial solution to this problem, growing the soybeans and using the soybean oil. Well, what are they looking at? They're looking, it was a brief study on a small population, and they were just looking at the fat content and what it costs. Nobody looks at long-term studies. Nobody looks at what the fish feel about this. And nobody looks at what the long-term result is of eating a fish that is from the sea versus eating a fish that has been farmed, eating a fish that has been farmed that has been fed a variety of different chemicals and different recipes for feed, whether they're from fish or for soy. It's quite complicated, and it would really be difficult to do, but frankly, it doesn't make sense to me. For example, let's just look at what I think is somewhat analogous. We're looking at the bees today that are dying in many areas, and I think we're beginning to realize that it has to do with the toxic chemicals that we put on the plants in these giant agri-farms. And the bees cannot live with all this toxin around them. And plus, we're taking away their honey and we're replacing it with sugar water or even worse, high fructose corn syrup water to feed these bees, and they're dying. And yet we see in small pockets in areas all around the world, these people that are growing hives themselves for a variety of different reasons. Some of them are for artisan honey, which, you know, I'm not that interested in, but others are just for their own farming needs, and to just see what happens. And in these biodynamic farms, organic farms, these bees are thriving. They eat their own honey. They get to nourish themselves from healthy plants. It's nature at its best, and it works. And so when we go to feed fish, food that they're not supposed to be eating, there has to be consequences. We certainly see, unfortunately, the consequences in the factory farming of land animals when we feed them things that they don't naturally eat. It results in illness and infection and discomfort. And then what we do is we come up with medicines to feed these animals in order to get them through their short life before slaughter. Doesn't it sound ridiculous to you? It sounds totally ridiculous to me. Okay, so that's the thing with tuna. So if you're thinking that vegetarians eat tuna, or that it's okay to eat tuna once in a while, just think for a moment before you make that choice, what happened to get that fish into that sandwich or that plate of food? If you just take a moment and think about that, to start with, if the fish was fish from the wild, it's not going to be as complicated a story as the fish that was farmed. But still, it takes, unless you're doing the fishing yourself, it's really quite a complicated journey to get the fish collected, farmed, shipped, packaged, canned, and then the material for the can, the oil that went in along with the can, and then more shipping, and it's quite a complicated process. It's not good for the environment. And tuna is also loaded with all kinds of garbage that we put in the oceans, like mercury. Do you really want to eat tuna? Is tuna that worth it? Now, when I'm thinking about it, I haven't had tuna fish in a very, very, very long time. But occasionally, when I want something like a tuna salad. It's really easy to make. There's lots of different recipes out there if you Google vegan tuna salad, for example. The kind that I like to make is when I make my own almond milk. It doesn't happen very often, but sometimes I like to make fresh almond milk, which is really simple. I soak my almonds. Let's say I take a cup of almonds, soak them in some cool water, and I put it in the refrigerator because I'm not quite sure when I'm going to get to blend it up. I usually leave it in overnight and then drain the water, rinse the almonds, put them in the blender with a cup of water, and it depends on the blender that you have. I have a really simple, not sophisticated one, so I do this step by step, and I blend the cup of water with the almonds. I pour the liquid through a mesh sieve into another container. I keep the fiber there, and I continue this process with another 3 or 4 cups of water. I might use 4 cups or 5 cups total water with the almonds, depending on how creamy I want that almond milk. And then I have this fiber left over from the almonds, and I don't like really to waste anything. So I take that fiber, and I chop up some celery. Usually one celery will go very nicely with that amount of almonds. 1 carrot. Chop it up really finely. Add about 1/4 onion. And I mix this all together. And then I might sprinkle in maybe 1/4 teaspoon of kelp powder or dulse, some sort of seaweed. Mix it up together. And that's my tuna salad. I think it's great. And it's good for you. While we're still talking about the ocean, I just want to bring to mind the Sea Shepherd organization, Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Have you heard of them, and have you been to their website, seashepherd.org? I really just want to send some virtual support out there for the people that are doing this kind of work. Number one, I'm a vegan and I don't believe in exploiting animals for any purpose. And I really like to talk about the big picture, where once you realize that animals are not out there for our own exploitation to do with as we please, then you start to think about how it affects your life and all life on earth. It's not just about cats and dogs and pigs and chickens, but all life. And all life has value. And so before you put something in your mouth that comes from another animal, or before you do whatever you do in your life, when you've lifted the veil, when you've looked into the other side, into the other room, metaphor you might think of, when you start to realize that humans are not necessarily God, and that other animals really deserve to live their lives freely, it just changes everything. And I personally am not one who likes to focus on one animal's plight or another. That's the point I'm trying to get here. But there are lots of organizations that focus on one animal or another, and they all deserve our help, all of them. So there are some people that, or some organizations that focus on fur and the animals that are used for fur, that are farmed for fur, or that get caught in traps for fur. Certainly there are lots of organizations that talk about the factory farmed animals that we eat, and this is the biggest population of exploitation of animals that are tortured and exploited for food. But there are anti-vivisection organizations for animals that are used in animal testing, and some of these experiments, if you've ever read about them, are so ridiculous. There may be some gray area in some people's minds, not mine, but in some people's minds about the value of some experiments on animals, but so many experiments, even today, are ridiculous. And there are many different organizations that focus on for poppy mills, animals raised in really obscene conditions in order to supply pet stores, There are different organizations that are fighting against the consumption of dog meat in Korea and horse meat. You can pick your animal. There's plenty of work to be done for so many of them in need. There are anti-rodeo organizations. I mean, the list is endless because we use animals for so many different things, not just for food, but for clothing and for entertainment. And it's for a lot of nonsense, unfortunately. Okay, back to the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. They focus on a variety of different things. I just wanted to read a brief thing from a recent commentary and editorial. After 35 years of intervention to defend marine life, we have not caused a single injury to any person, nor after some 350 voyages, this is Paul Watson, says, have I had any of my crew seriously injured. I am also proud of the fact that although we have been aggressively intervening against illegal whalers, sealers, dolphin killers, drift netters, trawlers, turtle killers, and other ocean life-destroying enterprises, we have always done so within the boundaries of the law. And unfortunately, well, they were having some really good results, really reducing the economic benefits from these ocean life-destroying enterprises. And then one of the unfortunate things happened. The Japanese tsunami was unfortunate in many ways, but what happened is that of hundreds of millions of dollars contributed from around the world to victims of that disaster, an allocation of some $30 million was given to whalers to fight Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. And certainly this is not what people who sent donations ever imagined that their contributions would be spent on. Rebuilding homes, food, medicine, repairing the infrastructure, yes, but to subsidize the operations of the whalers to continue killing whales in a sanctuary, who could have foreseen such a betrayal of trust? This is from the seashepherd.org website. I definitely recommend visiting them. Very, very brave individuals who have been working for decades for sea life. And Paul Watson actually is on the run right now and in hiding. And we really wish him well. There's his stories read like a thriller. And it's just really unfortunate what's going on for people that are risking their lives for these beautiful animals out there that are intelligent and majestic and manageable. Please visit seashepherd.org and read more about what they're doing. Oh, so again, for me, it's the big picture. I don't believe in exploitation of any kind for humans or non-humans. I don't like to participate in pain and suffering, but let's talk about some more things that are going on right now, and maybe you might be motivated to do something about what I'm going to be talking about next. I'm not a religious person. I was raised in the Jewish faith. I am currently, I like to describe myself as an atheist-leaning agnostic. What I do like about religion is some of the traditional foods. I like to veganize them, and I enjoy celebrating with family and friends with kind of veganized, evolved traditional foods. That's kind of a big mouthful, but I like to make it all delicious. So there are some big Jewish holidays coming up. And one of the things that's going on is something called Kaporos. And I'm going to read a recent post by the Friends of Animals. So, the Alliance to End Chickens as Kaporos was started in 2010 to protect the use of chickens in the ritual of Kaporos or Kaporot, which is a custom practiced by some Orthodox Jews right before Yom Kippur. Now, Yom Kippur is a big holiday in the Jewish religion, and what is normally done during this time is to ask God for forgiveness from sins from the past year, and then you move forward into your next year. That's my own little commentary here. Back to what I was reading. Not mandated in the Torah or the Talmud, it is estimated that 50,000 chickens are used in this ritual in Brooklyn alone every year. In 2010 and 2011, the Alliance to End Chickens held demos in Crown Heights, Williamsburg, and Midwood, posted online petitions, placed print ads in three publications, including the Jewish Press, Jewish Week, and Five Towns Jewish Times, placed animated ads that flashed 400,000 times over a week in 30 online Jewish publications, and purchased a brief spot on a Times Square billboard. And this year, they are inviting participation of sanctuaries and other animal groups and encouraging them to come with their banners to show that we stand together against this cruel and outdated practice. We realize it is difficult to attend a demo where animals are going to be tortured and killed. It's one of the hardest things most of us have ever done, but as hard as it is for us, it is infinitely harder for the chickens, and we must be there to speak out for them and show that we care. So, participating in this campaign also leads to the broader discussion of the way chickens are exploited and tortured in our society, and it can be a bridge to promoting veganism. When people express horror, as most do, over images depicting what Kaporos chickens go through, it provides an opportunity to point out that the chicken on their plate suffered no less. Right. So there are protests, and you might look up protests for Kaporos, which it's a Hebrew word, but in English it can be spelled K-A-P-O-R-O-S or K-A-P-P-A-R-O-T. And Sunday, September 23rd from 4 to 6 p.m. and Monday, September 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. there will be protests, and this will take place in Brooklyn on Eastern Parkway between Kingston and Albany Avenues, diagonally in front of the Brooklyn Jewish Children's Museum, 792 Eastern Parkway, Brooklyn, New York. So I just wanted to give you information about that. If you're more curious about that, you can email me at info@realmeals.org. I will, when I post this in the archives, have some links for you. I live in Forest Hills in Queens, New York, and there are a number of synagogues here, Orthodox ones, and I will never forget several years ago, and I relive it over and over, and I wish I had done something else. So perhaps this year, if I have the opportunity, I will do what I had intended to do before. But what happened was I passed this synagogue, which is right around the corner from where I live, and I was on my way to the subway. My mind was filled with many thoughts. I was not thinking about this temple or this upcoming tradition, but I noticed that there were a few women and children in the parking lot of this temple, and there were a few caged chickens. And right away, I made the connection. I knew what those chickens were for. And I walked by, and then I walked back, and I asked these adults what was going on, and I hadn't planned the conversation. I just saw the animals in the cages, and I had to say something. And I was saying, you know, do you realize what you're doing? Do you realize how innocent these animals are? It totally isn't necessary. The tradition, the original tradition, does not call for this practice of swinging animals over your head. The idea is that the sins will be moved to the animal and you swing them over their head. I mean, it's kind of a really crazy thing. And they all looked at me like deer in headlight expression, and they dumbfounded. The children were confused, and they basically said, "You don't understand." And I walked away, and later on I realized I did the wrong thing. What I should have done is spoken to the chickens. They would have heard me and they would have understood me. And I'm sorry that I didn't apologize to the chickens directly for their plight. I've told this story many times, but there was one time I was staying in the home of a woman who was hosting me. I was doing a show. was doing Evita in California, and I was staying in this woman's home, and she had one bird in a cage in the kitchen and one bird in a cage in a living room and a bunch of cats. And the bird in the kitchen seemed pretty lively. It got a lot of attention. It had light all day from the windows. But the bird in the living room was in the dark most of the time. And I didn't really understand what the point was. There's so many things I don't understand. But when my host wasn't home one day, I went into the living room and I looked at the bird in the cage and I spoke to it and I apologized for its plight. I told him there really wasn't anything I could do. And I sang a song from Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd, where this young woman who is 16 in the musical had been abducted by an older judge and her father had been run out of town, and she had been raised as the judge's ward and never was allowed to leave the home. So she, like birds in cages, was encaged herself. And she sang this beautiful song called Greenfinch and Linnet Bird, which I like to sing. And it was her asking the birds, "If I cannot fly, let me sing." Basically, singing was her expression. Her singing was her way to feel free or to not feel as the pain of exploitation and imprisonment. And so I sang this song to the bird in the cage in this dark room. And a couple of days later, my host came to me and she said, the funniest thing happened. She said this bird that she had in the living room hadn't sung in a long time, 6 months, I think she said, and it started singing again. I get kind of choked up every time I tell that story, but it really happened. And when I think about those birds in the cage for the Caporote ceremony, that's why I think I should have spoken directly to them. And perhaps, had I done that, the people might have had an opportunity to open up a little more. I don't know. But the next time, if I happen to pass that place of worship or another and I see the animals in the cage, I will definitely talk to them. You know, we have an expression here in New York for the transportation system. If you see something, say something. And it basically started after the unfortunate 9/11 incident over 11 years ago. And it's so that we can somewhat as a community protect each other. If you see a bag or someone looking mysterious, that you should say something to the authorities. But, you know, I feel it is so true of any injustice. If you see something, something must be said. We cannot be quiet. Now, there's a way of saying things. Unfortunately, if we just pour out our emotions and get angry and red in the face and yell at people, the response is not going to be positive. But there has to be a way to share this information from a place of love. I want to believe that people don't realize what they're doing, and there has to be a way to penetrate whatever it is that has been built around them for them not to realize what they're doing. We need to evolve. This is part of our evolution. And we're all responsible as a species to evolve and help each other get to a better place. I actually am rereading a book I read about 8 years ago, Empty Cages by Tom Regan. I met Tom Regan earlier this year in April, and he and his wife Nancy were visiting from North Carolina last week, and we met for dinner, and it was a lovely, lovely event. And so I was motivated to reread his most recent book, Empty Cages, and I scheduled to have him come on my It's All About Food show in October. He's a philosopher and has written a number of books on animal rights. And what I like about his writing is his wording is very gentle. It's very humble. It's very easy to digest. And it's helping me, to some extent, just remind myself. I certainly know what's going on, but sometimes it's helpful to read someone else's perspective, hear the language that they use, kind of remind you how to present an issue in order to make it more understandable and more compelling. I recommend checking out Empty Cages by Tom Regan, and look, kind of queue up in your calendar the interview that I'm going to have with him at the end of October. You can look at responsibleeatingandliving.com and go to the radio tab and click on upcoming guests and see when he will be on the show. Okay, have you heard it? Have you heard about the article that came out from Stanford University? The one that was called, "Are Organic Foods Safer or Healthier Than Conventional Alternatives?" You know, sometimes this research stuff can be so annoying. A lot of universities get by because they do research. They get a lot of grants, they get funding, and this allows them to continue. Research is very important. It's important because we learn things from it, and it's important to support scientific research. Unfortunately, a lot of research, a lot of people look to do research in order to support themselves financially. And there may be some bias, whether researchers realize it or not. I know for my nonprofit, I look for grants all the time that I might apply for, and it's next to impossible to find grants that want to support what I think is important in terms of educating people about healthy plant-based foods. There are research grants that will focus on nutrition for children and to fight obesity and to deal with nutrition in areas of poverty, and all of that is very important. But there's very little support for making the connection between the impact on the environment and environmental sustainability and factory farming, and really nothing that supports promoting a vegan lifestyle. And universities are a great source for research, and so they look for grants. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure who supported this particular grant for seeing if organic foods are healthier than conventional alternatives, but the study was not really very good. And often what happens is you get these sound bites that all the news agencies pick up on and they promote. You don't get the whole story. And so the sound bite that came out of this study is that there's no strong evidence that organic foods are more nutritious than conventional foods. So everybody goes, oh, why am I paying more money for organic food if it's not more nutritious? There's a lot of things that were wrong with this study. Mother Jones came out with an article, 5 Ways the Stanford Study Sells Organic Short, and I will post a link to this article. It's definitely worth reading if you want to understand all the things that were wrong or poorly done in this article. One of the problems is it was another one of these mega analyses where they take a lot of other different studies and try and glean information from them so that they can make some overall conclusions. And there's a lot of problems with it because they're using information from many different places that were set up in many different ways and then using all kinds of fancy mathematical manipulations in order to try and figure something out. And ultimately what happened in this report is that it's really kind of complicated to explain, but just in terms of pesticide residues, for example, organic food that may have had very little residue were lumped in the same categories as conventional foods that had lots of pesticide residues or pesticide and herbicide residues from many different chemicals versus, you know, a small amount from one or very few in the organic food. And they all get lumped in together and all kinds of conclusions are made that really aren't fair, aren't unbiased, and clearly support the conventional alternative. So you wonder who was behind funding of the study. And I can't believe that, you know, Stanford, it's such a great place of great work and smart people, how they could put out such crap. There's so many things that need to be brought out about organic farming, and even better, organic biodynamic farming, where there's such a wide range of nutrition that we probably haven't even identified yet that are in organic foods that are not in conventional foods. How could there not be? For example, conventional foods, the soil is so depleted from reusing the same area for planting over and over without rotating, without re-nourishing the soil naturally. So farmers have to use petrochemical fertilizers in order to add some simple chemicals back into the soil, nitrogen and phosphorus, and then all kinds of chemicals to keep other life from growing, like bugs and weeds, in order to get these plants to grow. So the plants grow, but they can't possibly have the vast array of nutrition in them that would come out of a natural soil that is alive, teeming with life. When you go into the woods, for example, and you see the soil that's there from thousands and thousands of years of leaves falling and twigs falling and decomposing and going back into the soil, that soil is so rich and alive. And in sustainable farming, organic and biodynamic farming, the farmers try and simulate that sort of thing by adding in different plants adjacent to the plants that they're growing for sale or for use in other products. And there's lots of different plants that can be grown that put nutrition into the soil that the other plants are going to use. It's a symbiotic relationship. Unfortunately, there's a lot of knowledge that we've lost in this area, but more and more people are learning how to get it back. And I wish that there were more studies, more long-term studies, that would compare the life of the soil and all the components that are in a healthy, organic, biodynamic soil versus a conventional, and I hate that word, an industrial farm soil. We hear all the time about how we're having tremendous loss of topsoil from our conventional farms, and part of the reason is the soil is so unhealthy and dry, but another thing is the root system from the plants that are being grown are so shallow. What happens is they barely go into the surface of the soil. They just get what they need from the top, which is where the petrochemical fertilizers are being added, whereas in a more sustainable area, the roots actually can reach down, way down under, and grow deep into the earth. And this strengthens the soil. And in dry times, in drought times, the roots are so deep that they can get water from really way down below. This is the way plants are supposed to grow. and we've gotten so far away from this in industrial farming. These are the things you don't read about in these superficial articles, like the one that just came out of Stanford. So really, be careful about what you read. If you have any questions about a particular article, something that's food-related that has said something with results that you're not happy about or you're surprised to see, I'd be happy if you send me a link to that article and I could do a little research on it and come back and give you my opinion on it. I'd be really happy to do that. Do we have to keep talking about soda? I talk about soda a lot. Well, soda is in the news very, very often because we're realizing that America is eating way too much sugar, and a lot of that sugar comes from soda. And there are different people that are trying to make a difference. Mayor Bloomberg here in New York is trying to get legislation passed in order to help people make more sensible decisions about what they put in their bodies and to help the health crisis that we're experiencing and to reduce obesity, especially in young people. There's something in the news most recently in Richmond, California, which is an area where there's a lot of low-income people and obesity, and the neighborhood was trying to do what they could by putting a tax on beverages sold in that community. And they had a Measure N that was coming up on the November ballot to force local businesses to pay a penny per ounce tax on sales of sugar-sweetened beverages. And a companion measure advises the city to spend an estimated $3 million in annual revenues on recreation and anti-obesity programs. So they're trying to target this health issue in a number of different ways, but there's plenty of information out there today that shows that education to some extent works, but what works the most is what hits our wallets. And when luxury items or sugary, unhealthy items are more expensive, people don't buy them as much. It shows over and over. There are people out there that are crying that they don't want their freedom impinged upon, and by making sugary beverages more expensive, they think it's not fair. But what they don't realize is all the money that is put behind these unhealthy foods that's invisible to all of us, that make them more attractive and convince us to buy them. It's not about freedom. I have to say this over and over again because there's a lot of people that don't get it. When the sugars are subsidized and they're made cheaper by our tax dollars, they make these sugary beverages cheaper. We could be doing the same thing with dark green vegetables and making them really inexpensive and putting a lot of money into media to make them sexy and appealing, and more people would be eating them. It's that simple. The sad thing about this particular one is that what happened was in Richmond, in trying to get this penny per ounce tax measure on the ballot and get people to vote for it, of course, there were a lot of industries that were putting money into anti-tax campaigns. So there was about $350,000 that has gone into the anti-tax on the soda in this community. $350,000 just for this small little community, and about $7,000 was put into information campaigns to support this particular measure. That's really different. $7,000 to support the measure versus $350,000 mostly coming from corporate industry to defeat this ballot. And the money went mostly into mass mailings, which I find really annoying. We're getting a lot of mass mailings in the mail right now. All this paper that is so wasteful. I don't look at it. I just put it into the shredder, and it's really sad just for that alone. So this all this paper being wasted, all this money being spent in order to prevent this tax from happening, penny per ounce tax on sugar sweetened beverages? Well, the Community Coalition Against Beverage Taxes, which is funded by the American Beverage Association, has spent more than $350,000 in an effort to defeat Measure N, a November ballot measure that could force local businesses to pay a penny per ounce tax on sales of sugar-sweetened beverages. I'm reading this from an article that recently posted. And a federal judge in San Francisco on Friday blocked the city's attempt to force a beverage industry-funded campaign group to comply with a campaign disclosure rule on its political mailers. So, they have this great little ordinance that was passed in June that requires all mass mailings to be accompanied by the words "major funding by" and include the five largest contributors with information on the front page of all distributed material. That's nice because you get these mailings, and if you do look at them, I usually don't, but if you do, you can see, at least in this, in Richmond, California, based on their ordinance that was passed, you can see who funded the group that was sending out this mailing. We should know this. And yet, the district court in San Francisco ruled against this campaign disclosure, saying that it violated the First Amendment. It doesn't really make much sense. You wonder who's behind it. And this is all simply about soda, right? Okay, quickly, just a few more things, because we're coming to the end of the show. Have you heard about Rosie O'Donnell? Well, unfortunately, she had a heart attack. She wasn't hospitalized, but it did scare her enough into deciding to eat plant-based. There's another celebrity going the V way, so that's exciting, and let's follow up on her progress. The thing is, none of us should be scared into eating foods because we don't want to get a heart attack. We should just make the right choice. It's the right choice for so many reasons. These foods are delicious and they're health promoting. I just hope more people get the message. And I had an opportunity to eat at a lovely restaurant this week called Rouge Tomate in New York City. And I wanted to talk about it briefly for a number of reasons. Number one, it is not a vegetarian restaurant, but more and more restaurants, fortunately, are offering vegan options. And this particular place had such creative food, I couldn't help but want to bring it up and talk about it. And I learned a few things because I want to make some of these things at home. So to start with, they had some appetizers or table foods. And many people are familiar with the bruschetta, which is a chopped fresh tomato with a little garlic and olive oil served on a piece of toast. Well, I don't know if you've had these things, but they're delicious. But typically, the bread is really hard and crunchy and thick. And you bite into it and everything kind of falls over and it's messy and you need a napkin. And especially when these things are supposed to be at parties or finger foods or something, they can really be unfortunately messy. Well, some of the things that they served at this particular restaurant were toasts, these lovely, to start with, they used very, very thin bread that was toasted. It was like a cracker, but no, it was a bread. And it was very easy to bite into. And then they stacked on it in a very neat, lovely little tower that all stuck together. It wasn't something that just crumbled and fell over and got messy. A variety of different toppings. And I wanted to just highlight some of them. Can I pull them up here? Yeah, here they are. So seasonal toasts. They had baby artichoke, which had basil and garlic in it. Just delicious. And some of these are not vegetarian, but they can make them vegetarian for you. There was a summer vegetable ratatouille served on a toast, and a tomato with different herbs. And a spring vegetable, all of these really lovely. So there were kind of spins on the bruschetta, only using different vegetables, different flavorings, different herbs, and fabulous. They had a lovely vegan risotto and a lovely vegan vegetable plate with vegetables that I don't even know what they were, things that were very fresh and unusual and somewhat exotic. They had vegan options of every course. So I really want to commend Rouge Tomat for their really innovative, beautiful offerings. They had a lovely vegetable terrine. And I just encourage more and more restaurants to do this because there are more of us out there, vegetarians and vegans, and we do deserve to either regularly or for celebration eat well and eat in a beautiful ambiance with lovely, lovely foods. And so I hope more restaurants will take this on to not only offer foods that are organic, biodynamic, sustainable, but also cruelty-free. This week, I offer a couple of recipes. One is my leek and lentil soup, and I mentioned kelp powder before. I want to say something about kelp powder. I don't like to use salt. Occasionally, I do use some kelp powder, but you have to be careful with kelp powder. A half a teaspoon of kelp powder can be potentially dangerous for one individual to consume on a regular basis because it has a lot of iodine in it, but maybe a tenth to an eighth of a teaspoon of kelp powder. Now, I have a kelp powder that I grinded myself, so it's not as dense as a kelp powder you might buy in a bottle. But I use about a half a teaspoon of my own kelp powder, which is maybe probably less than a real powder, a half teaspoon of kelp. But I put it in a soup that I serve to 8 people. And I find it brings out some of the flavor because it is a little bit salty and it does have some iodine in it, which we all need. But not too much, just a little bit. And I made a lovely leek and lentil soup with a little kelp powder in it. And you can find that recipe at responsibleeatingandliving.com. One of the questions I got was, I use red lentils in my soup, and the question was, can I use other lentils? And the answer is, of course. We don't discriminate here at Responsible Eating and Living about your lentils. Red lentils, green lentils, brown lentils, white lentils, any lentils are good lentils. They all taste actually about pretty similarly. So any of them would work. Enjoy them. You've been listening to Ask a Vegan. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for listening. And remember, Responsible Eating and Living is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, and we do what we do with support from listeners like you. Please check out our donation tab, and if you have the opportunity, you can send us a donation. We would greatly appreciate it. It's tax-deductible. Thanks so much.
R-E-A-L.
Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
R-E-A-L.
Real's good for the planet, the inhabitants who need sound advice on the right thing to do.
When it comes to good health,
we need facts that are true. To choose what to eat and save the planet too. As responsible eating and living.
R-E-A-L.
You'll find the real tools for you.
Real.